So for our viewers and listeners, would you have any interesting anecdotes to share on how you pivoted your brands or what you did to refresh your brand?
I think the my biggest story, of course, is about Cadbury's Dairy Milk, right? In which the entire episode was born out of, let's say, push-pull intuition. And I think it's extremely interesting in the sense that the brand had been there for a very long time. And at the same time, it needed a particular push. We knew what we had to do. We had to basically, obviously, appeal to, let's say, a much larger population as such. But the so-called departure from, let's say, the so-called core which the brand represented had to have, let's say, a certain amount of escape velocity, as I call it, right? And if you don't have that escape velocity, the brand doesn't sort of escape from, let's say, the so-called core value which it has or the core benefit which it has. When you have to generate that escape velocity, I think that's basically where the marketeer's instinct comes in. Because typically, marketeers plan, basically based on certain tools which they have, namely research, which is much maligned, but I don't believe that. All right. Do actually sort of tend to do incremental things to take it out of, let's say, the ordinary. But you need to actually have that escape velocity and you need to be bold enough to perhaps back that particular escape velocity as such.
Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a vodcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. If you are new to our channel, consider subscribing to it and hit the bell icon so that you never miss an update. Our episodes go live at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. every day. I am your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I am privileged and delighted to welcome not just a good friend, a fellow YPO member, but probably one of the very, very senior corporate professional managers from India, Rajiv Bakshi. Rajiv, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ashutosh.
Rajiv has been the former chairman of PepsiCo India. He was the former managing director of Metro Cash and Carry. He was the former managing director of Cadbury India and South Africa, and he's a member of several boards. So, Rajiv, given the fact that you spent your entire life with brands, I'm going to talk to you about brands today. What goes into building a successful brand?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. In terms of being successful, I think there are a couple of things in this. One is that you have to take, let's say, a particular position which is different from basically what other products have been taking or other brands have been taking. And then you have to stay the course on that. Obviously, when you take a different direction on a particular brand, it has to make a lot of business sense on one side. And the other side, it needs to actually sort of appeal to a larger set of consumers who basically recognize that particular offering or brand as such as basically a particular departure from the other brands or other product categories as such, or it has something new to say. So clearly, I think what you have to do is to basically A, depart from the regular, number one. Number two, appeal to, let's say, a certain set of audiences, whether large or small, doesn't matter. And at the same time, tell the story very effectively so that there is, let's say, a certain amount of aha and a latent, let's say, need, which basically comes to the surface.
And following on from what you've said, brands are living beings. The more you invest in, the better they get. But there are brands like the ones that you have worked with, which are Pepsi and Cadbury, which have been relevant for 100 years or 70 years or whatever. And there are brands which die. What, in your opinion, should a brand be doing to stay relevant for a long period of time?
I think it's a very curious mixture of basically staying the course and consistency, and at the same time, refreshing the brand every, let's say, other year as such. And the refreshment can be in various dimensions. It can be in the dimension of basically saying something new, or perhaps addressing a new need, or perhaps, let's say, combined with, let's say, product innovation as such, to be able to tell a very different story. So clearly, there are some categories. Cadbury, for example, is a brand which basically the product has remained consistent over the years. It's meant the same things. But in generation after generation, as the demographics evolve, it starts meaning very different things to different people as such. And it has to therefore refresh itself to stay the course and stay contemporary as such. So therefore, there it's obviously, let's say, in terms of redefining the meaning of the brand to appeal to a different set of demographics. In other cases, basically, you have situations in which you perhaps have to reinvent the brand. Let's say, talk about Metro Cash and Carry, right? You're talking about a physical retail presence. That brand basically has to be combined with, let's say, a different product form, which basically then is contemporary to actually sort of, you know, accrue value to the brand or add to the brand's cachet. So I think it means different things to different people, but eventually, basically, it is about reinventing yourself or reinventing the communication along with, let's say, the change of demographics and or other consumer demographics and or other, let's say, so-called angles as far as the general population is concerned.
Interesting. So for our viewers and listeners, would you have any interesting anecdotes to share on how you pivoted your brands or what you did to refresh your brand?
I think my biggest story, of course, is about Cadbury's Dairy Milk, right? In which the entire episode was born out of, let's say, push-pull intuition. And I think it's extremely interesting in the sense that the brand had been there for a very long time. And at the same time, it needed a particular push. We knew what we had to do. We had to basically, obviously, appeal to, let's say, a much larger population as such. But the so-called departure from, let's say, the so-called core which the brand represented had to have, let's say, a certain amount of escape velocity, as I call it, right? And if you don't have that escape velocity, the brand doesn't sort of escape from, let's say, the so-called core value which it has or the core benefit which it has. When you have to generate that escape velocity, I think that's basically where the marketeer's instinct comes in. Because typically, marketeers plan, you know, basically based on certain tools which they have, namely research, which is much maligned, but I don't believe that. All right. Do actually sort of tend to do incremental things to take it out of, let's say, the ordinary. But you need to actually have that escape velocity and you need to be bold enough to perhaps back that particular escape velocity as such. And that's the most difficult thing to do, especially when the product remains the same. Right. So this example basically is about the product remaining the same, but at the same time, actually sort of having a departure from the core and having an escape velocity to make the brand actually move out of its original orbit and you do something startlingly different. Now, clearly the strategy existed that you have to make the brand universal or the category universal in India. But at the same time, the so-called, let's say, tools of doing that were by and large, let's say, what you were coming up with were incremental. And you needed a very bold departure, let's say, from where you were to where you wanted to be.
Okay.
And that's when basically the inspiration of the marketeer and the so-called communicator, sort of people, the agency, as we call it, right, comes into being in terms of having a partnership to invent something bold as such and to invent a departure. And it's a bet, it's a punt, it's a risk, which basically you have to take. Whereas the famous part is that, of course, let's say when I did, let's say, the Kuch Khaas Hai Zindagi campaign, I think people saw the end product. What they didn't see was the 6 months or 9 months, actually about a year of trial and error, which went into it as such, till we found the perfect formula with one couple of failures in the middle. What they didn't see was basically that the agency almost was turfed out as such, because they couldn't come up with a breakthrough solution as such. And I think there were a lot of pain which actually went into it. But at the end of it, I think if you stay the course and keep on finding that particular inspiration to get that particular escape velocity in this case, I think that actually sort of cracked the entire category. Which, interestingly, I mean, that escape velocity as it was found in 1994, 27 years on, it is still basically staying the course there and then building on it as the case may be.
Fascinating. So, you know, you're one of the few people, Rajiv, who I have seen over the last 3.5 decades who has actually handled big brands. And from the time, you know, it was physical distribution and making sure the distributor has stocks, etc., to running Metro Cash and Carry and evolving into the digital world. My question to you is that how are brands, big brands, coping with the new digital world?
I think what you asked is a very great question. And there are some brands which are, some brands which are not, right? And I can take examples basically from the apparel world, for example, in which many brands have not actually sort of cut it. And therefore, their over-reliance on brick and mortar has obviously been their Waterloo as such.
Correct.
And there are other brands which obviously have actually sort of coped with this and departed from let's say real. There are very few examples of, let's say, omni-channel brands, which basically have had their DNA in the so-called physical world and then have converted into, let's say, the digital world in a big way. At this stage, I think most of the brands are actually experimenting with the digital world, especially the old legacy brands.
Okay.
All right. I don't think there are many examples of brands which have actually taken the right turn and got the dependency on the digital world to a larger extent, in the sense that more than proportionately. So I think it's been a tough one, because typically I think to actually sort of, you know, cut roots with their legacy has always been a very tough proposition for businesses, and businesses typically are inertia prone. So I think the issue is obviously about changing the wheels of the car while you're driving the car, and that's basically what is happening, and that's what's led to this particular phenomena of perhaps the so-called, you know, physical form of the distribution and or conventional form of the distribution remaining, let's say, as a lead proposition in any case for most of these guys, because it's risk aversion. So the answer is, in brief, not very well, if you're talking about the legacy brands.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they're bolting on, but at the same time, are they coping it very well? The answer is, I don't think so at this stage.
Very interesting. And therefore, a follow-up question for you is, say, two of your big brands, Cadbury and Pepsi, you know, came to your retail brand, which is Metro. And now comes an Amazon or a big basket and disintermediates Metro. How do the big brands like Cadbury and Pepsi react to the big digital platforms or e-commerce platforms now?
It's a very, very difficult proposition, in the sense that by itself, if you look at, let's say, Cadbury and Pepsi, they are physical. They are actually over dependence of physical distribution, because they are, let's say, at a point of impulse. They are consumed at a point of impulse as such. And by and large, let's say, specifically soft drinks, while, let's say, internationally, yes, there is a reasonable mixture of planned versus impulse. But in India, I think it's largely on the impulse side, as such, on the beverages. And in confectionery also, let's say, it's an equal sort of a mix. Having said that, I think it's very important to actually sustain your physical distribution. So clearly, I think from that point of view, they have to cope with this disintermediarization to a large extent. Now, the issue is, how do they sustain their businesses as such in this particular context? Now, that is a very, very tricky question for them, because what they have to find is basically, how do they actually sort of over-index on their current form of distribution? And I don't think they have too much of an option but to do that in terms of over-indexing on the current form of distribution, and or finding alternative, let's say, route to market versus, let's say, the conventional, you know, distributor, retailer sort of a paradigm as such. Have they done that successfully? The answer is no. Has Pepsi done it to a large extent? The answer is, to some extent, yes, in terms of perhaps, you know, basically tying up with food and beverage partners and so on and so forth. But having said that, I think it's extremely important for them to actually get into physical distribution, and they can't get away from that, frankly. They're not great examples of basically who get impacted by this, because their options are very limited.
Very interesting. As such. Very interesting. So, you know, my next question, Rajiv, is that, you know, you and I are of a similar vintage. When I was growing up in ITC, etc., you know, analytics was 13 column sheets, which evolved into Lotus 1-2-3, which evolved into, you know, Microsoft Excel. But today, and you still run large companies, you still chair boards, how is analytics now changing branding, and what is it doing to support decision making?
I think very significant, in the sense that, you know, when companies are reinventing themselves, right, One is, of course, let's say the so-called distance between the consumer and the company went through about three layers. Right. Now, that distance is narrowing. Has it narrowed to a large extent? The answer is no, but it's narrowing big time as such. And it is a very interesting phenomenon in the sense when it narrows, you actually then basically have some options which open out for you. But the issue is that the skills required to leverage that as such become, let's say, a little tricky as such. Now, some people say to a large extent that basically marketeers who basically were also obviously banking on intuition as such to market themselves, that particular paradigm is dead, right? So subjective marketing is dead as such. And that's a very extreme position to take. And that's been taken by, let's say, a few people internationally as well, that basically, you know, marketeers as a profession is a dying profession from in a conventional sense. And therefore, basically, it's not about marketing. It's basically about, let's say, business analytics and strategy, and therefore getting to the consumer.
Right.
Now, that is a position which a couple of, let's say, international companies have taken. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, is the journey to that particular position very smooth? The answer is no. Mm-hmm. It's horses for courses. It depends on companies. So therefore, there are, let's say, for example, credit card companies, etc., which have taken that position. Mm-hmm. All right. Whereas basically there are, let's say, certain other companies which are still grappling with basically how do you marry the two in terms of basically using analytics to get closer to the consumer and therefore make decision making a little more smoother. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, also simultaneously, you know, using the marketeer's intuition to actually get there.
Interesting.
So I think it's a very interesting, curious mix. Also, I think the new age businesses as such, which are primarily digital first businesses, have actually sort of used data analytics and therefore almost made the marketing function dispensable.
Wow.
Right? Mm. Or at least claiming that, or at the same time, maybe perhaps downgrading it to a large extent. Mm. And in some companies, it's almost disappeared as such.
Very interesting. Go ahead, Rajiv. Sorry.
So basically what I'm saying is that, you know, the new age digital company, but at the same time, if let's say conventional companies are going to use it as such, it's very much the same as the previous question you asked me in terms of a very curious mixture of, let's say, the so-called trying to grapple with analytics, trying to use it, coming closer to the consumer, thinking that they're actually sort of supplementing the marketeer's subjective judgment, partly so, but not wholly so as of now.
Okay. So, you know, when my young colleagues heard that I'm going to be talking to you, one of the questions they asked me to ask you was that for someone of your stature who has run so many companies, CEO, chairman, what in your important view are some of the important qualities a CEO should have?
I think the biggest quality to my mind, I think, is basically, it may sound very cliched, but at the same time, to perhaps think differently from the conventional, right? In the sense that you almost are basically, see, organizations are very inertia prone. Mm-hmm. And CEOs, you can actually become a maintenance CEO very easily as such, and therefore sort of move into the flow. Now, the issue is that you always obviously are looking for the new frontiers and businesses and business development areas. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at that, all right, how do you actually sort of start strategizing differently? And I think one of the reasons why I was successful is basically I had a marketeer's mindset in which I actually sort of believed in the principle of, let's say, creative destruction, which means move from one phase to the next, to the next, to the next as right. such, and use the marketeer's analogy to basically sort of apply it to becoming, let's say, a business leader, and therefore believe in that and therefore move from one to the next. And that's the context I talk about in terms of being able to actually move from one dimension to the next. And that is the marketeer's mindset, clearly, along with, of course, large dollops of strategy to make the entire thing a nice story, as such, a nice plan, story or a plan or whatever you want to call it. The second thing is basically that, and this is very important, is that how do you actually spin that story? All right. Storytelling is a big, big issue in a big area. Mm. All right. Because spinning that story is equally, if not more important than creating the story. Mm. All right. Because spinning that story actually means that you are now communicating, you are now advertising in a sense. Again, I'm using a marketer's analogy, that you are actually sort of presenting it in a particular form, which means you're doing a commercial, a TV commercial, so to speak, a 30-second or a 60-seconder, and then you're communicating through that. Here, of course, you're communicating more directly. So therefore, it's about spinning a story and spinning a yarn, and therefore trying to do storytelling. And then basically, obviously, sort of when you're doing that, you obviously then nurture the consumer or nurture, let's say, your employees to perhaps believe in that story and at the same time satisfy their needs. So if you notice that entire my entire success paradigm has been built on, let's say, a marketeer's analogy.
Fantastic.
Right? It's
often been said that all the blue eyes are in marketing, haven't it? So
I wish. But Abhish, basically, if you look at the three things that I told you, is nothing else but basically, a marketeer's analogy in terms of saying, okay, fine, create a story, create, let's say, a new dimension, communicate the story, sell the story, and then nurture and basically then satisfy the needs of the person who's receiving the story.
Very interesting.
Right? And therefore, then basically talk about people orientation and all that cliches which come along with it. So risk taking and therefore spinning that particular new dimension is very, very critical. So I think that's, if you ask me, that's the way I would put it.
Fantastic. So I'm going to ask you one question on board of directors and then move to a few questions for you personally. You know, a lot of people who superannuate out of organizations want to join boards. And now we know that non-executive board members have similar fiduciary responsibilities as executive directors. You sit on several boards. My question to you is, what do you look for before you accept a board position?
Firstly, I don't accept board positions. All right. My board positions are basically born out of, let's say, some historical issues which I was on boards. And at the same time, in terms of in the board where I am right now, I have somewhat direct or indirect control over the affairs of the company.
Okay,
so I don't get into boards very easily. In fact, not at all. In fact, I don't accept board positions unless basically I'm really into the operation of the company. So I think that's my personal choice. And the reason why I do that is that I think I want to do something more meaningful than just basically sit on boards in a somewhat passive-active capacity as such. And most of the assignments that I've had, let's say, post my so-called, not superannuation is a bad word, but let's say after I hung up my boots in my permanent assignment, is basically looking at positions and operating assignments where perhaps, let's say, I can go deep into the operations of the company and spend 2-3 days in a month at least actually working actively with a particular engagement which I have. And if required, then also get into the board as such.
Okay.
Which then obviously, let's say, besides minimizing the risk, as we call it, about the fiduciary risk, as we call it, all right, also actually helps me in terms of guiding that company's fortune much more meaningfully.
Very interesting. So I've got time for two more questions for you.
Sure.
I'm trying to decide what to ask you. But one question I'm going to ask you is that what are some of the core values you have believed in? Because, you know, you've accomplished a hell of a lot in your life.
Core values, I think it's interesting in the sense that I think I'm a very typical middle-class guy who basically have actually sort of self-made as such. And therefore, I think in terms of basically, I think personal integrity is a big, big, big issue with me. For example, I mean, I'll just tell you one simple thing, which I hate to be in debt, right? Personal debt is anathema as far as I'm concerned. Now, people say, what a stupid guy, basically, doesn't take risks and so on. But
yeah,
it's basically an example in which basically I don't want to owe anything to anybody, right? So I believe basically in myself. But the other very interesting facet, which I must talk about here, and it's very interesting. I struggle to think as to who my role model is. Okay, I can't name one. And I struggle to name one. Now, what does that mean? And when I reflect on it, I say, okay, what does that mean? So is it that basically I believe in myself too much? Am I too arrogant to actually say that? I don't know. But at the same time, it's obviously, I think, born out of a very fierce sense of independence. as such, in terms of that I believe in myself to do what I have to in life. So I don't know whether I'm asking a question directly, but I think maybe indirectly I'm answering a question. But it's this very fierce, independent mindset which I have, fiercely independent mindset which I have, and obviously born out of, let's say, a certain sense of, you know, a burning desire to perhaps, let's say, accomplish something against odds and so on, which I think is extremely important, accompanied by a very high degree of personal integrity and not being indebted to anybody.
Fantastic.
Now, very roundabout sort of a way to answer your question.
No, but it's a great answer.
That's who I am.
I believe you completely, because I too don't have any role models, you know. And
interesting.
What would your advice be to a young individual who's starting off on her or his corporate career?
Very difficult to say, in the sense that I think I am now two generations removed from basically the start of, let's say, a person who's actually starting a corporate career. And the world is a very different place to when I started my career as such. And I think it's very important for them to perhaps, let's say, at this stage, I would reckon that, you know, basically the options are much more open nowadays and they have many options. But at the same time, I think you have to have a particular, you know, either, let's say, a lodestar or maybe an internal urge, like, for example, what I just said right now, to perhaps do something. One thing which basically I do not definitely recommend or perhaps condone is the issue of basically, you know, trying various different things and let me see what fits, so to speak. And that is a sense of drift, which I am not very convinced about, frankly. So I think there has to be a sense of objective in terms of where you're going. Now, I think in our situations when we were growing up, the entire, let's say, sense of objective was not in terms of perhaps the sort of career which we chose. So therefore, there was a linearity in terms of the career options which we had. But at the same time, there was, let's say, an inner sense to actually sort of, you know, apply ourselves to that particular career. And that differentiated, let's say, the good from the bad. Don't make the mistake of perhaps, let's say, thinking that you have too many options and therefore let me see what fits before we actually decide as such. If you actually layer that on with, let's say, saying that basically I have a certain end lodestar or an end objective in mind or an end guiding star in mind, which could be born out of a sense of values or your innermost desire to do certain things, become ABC top of this profession, then it may make sense. So again, I mean, I'm not answering your question directly, but again, I'm answering indirectly and saying that, listen, drift, but at the same time, see, if you have a linearity of career, like basically what we did, right, it's fine, as long as you have a sense of purpose. But if you basically are so-called trying various things, which the youngsters actually today want to do as such and do actually sort of swear by that, fair enough. But at the same time, I think there has to be intensity in terms of what exactly are you trying to do at the end of it. There has to be an objective in mind as such.
Fantastic.
And the sooner that you actually sort of talk about it, think about it, the better it is.
Amazing. Rajiv, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you. I mean, what an amazing journey you've had. Thank you for sharing such amazing experiences, which I'm sure people will learn a lot from. Thank you again.
Thank you, Ashutosh, for your kind words. I think, I don't know whether I deserve that or not, but it's been lovely talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website www.tbcy.in to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.